Dear listeners, welcome to Faces of Digital Health, a podcast about digital health and how healthcare systems adopt technologies. I am your host, Tiasza Zeiss, and today we will move away from specific technologies or country profiles to a topic important for startups and company success, communication and pitching. I spoke with Beth Suzanne, international pitch coach from the US based in Spain, who coached over 3,000 teams so far, over 200 in digital health. No matter if you're a startup or a corporation, team communication is key to success, either for company growth or fundraising. In the discussion you are about to hear, Beth explains what makes a presentation effective, why a personal story may not always be the best choice, and how important, besides your words, are your confidence and body language. Enjoy the discussion or click to the link in the show notes to go directly to our website where you can find the summary of this discussion. Beth, you were born in the US and lived there for a very long time. You're currently based in Spain, but you also lived in various places around Europe, starting with France and Amsterdam. Your children live in the UK. So why did you leave US in the first place? Why leave the land of opportunities?
Initially, when I went to France, I was in university and I had enormous desire to go to France and see Europe and just to explore and to find out what it was like, because I had only lived in the U.S. I grew up outside of New York City and in Los Angeles, and then I went to school in Northern California at University of California at Davis, just outside of Sacramento. So I had studied French, and I really was interested in finding out the European life was like, especially in France. After I graduated, I went to Washington, D.C. and worked for a number of years. And then I went to San Francisco, and I had always wanted to go back to Europe, but I had married a New Zealander. And so we kept going in the other direction. Then my children decided to go to university, one in London at Brunel and the other one at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. And I had the feeling they would never come back to the U.S. and I had wanted to move back to Europe anyway. So I came back and ended up in Amsterdam actually for 4 years, which I really loved, and then moved to Spain. I'm in Barcelona, just south of Barcelona actually, in a little town called Sitges on the beach. It's been great. I love living here.
What are your hands-on experiences with healthcare systems in these different countries?
I actually also lived in Ecuador. I worked in South America as part of what was called the Peace Corps, and I was living in Quito. So I actually got quite ill in France and ended up in the hospital, and I got ill in Ecuador, ended up in the hospital. And I've been involved in the U.S. healthcare system for majority of my life, and then been in Amsterdam, and I went to a number of doctors there, and then now in Spain. And I can say that the best healthcare system out of all of them is the Spanish one. It's technologically, it's really sort of cutting edge. The quality of the care is really, really high. They are opening up to alternative healthcare. It's not quite as advanced in terms of cutting edge in terms of the alternatives as some other cultures, but it's also free, I mean, or close to free. I have a private healthcare that I pay 39 euros, which is, I guess, about $42-$43 a month for. It covers everything except for vision and teeth, and they take care of you. I mean, it's really high quality. It's been amazing. And they see you right away in Spain. You know, you don't have to wait. And my experiences in France were a long time ago, and it was very hierarchical in France. Like, there was no questioning the doctor, et cetera. And so it was just quite rigid. And I don't know if it's changed now, but in South America, I remember that the quality, and this was a long time ago also, decades ago, it wasn't cutting edge at all. Now I understand it's changed in Ecuador, but it was quite behind the times. So the hospital wasn't actually quite clean. So I was only there one one day and I left. I didn't want to stay. In the U.S., it's just super expensive. And they make you take millions of tests. And remember, I was paying $1,200 a month for a premium, and then you have a $6,000 a year deductible before they start reimbursing you. It's just extremely expensive. You can't afford it. It's just unbelievable, shocking. So a very high percentage of bankruptcies in the U.S. are medical bankruptcies. At one point, about 8 years ago, I read an article saying that 83% of them of the bankruptcies were medical bankruptcies. I don't know if that's really accurate anymore, but people are beggared by when they become ill. It's really awful. Whereas in Spain, you know, you're taken care of. It's amazing. And in the Netherlands, they have very high quality technology, and the doctors, they see you fairly quickly, but they are really hesitant or reluctant to give you help, the medication. It's the opposite of the U.S. The U.S., they just bombard you with the tests and the medication. In Netherlands, you don't get the medication, you don't get the tests. They say, well, let's wait and see until you get really sick, and then you come back. Whereas in Spain, it's like a happy medium. It's really, really wonderful.
What was your experience in the U.S. with the healthcare system when you worked as a strategist, you know, for various projects?
Yes, I worked consulting with healthcare architect firms in San Francisco. I coached them to win the UCSF Medical Hospital South of Market, and I coached them to win the Mills Peninsula Hospital in Millbrae. There was a real awareness of patient-centric care, sort of the healing properties of taking care of people so that they felt humanized instead of dehumanized. And this was quite a while ago. This was, you know, 20 years ago or a bit more even. And it was quite ahead of its time, I think, in terms of, because it was in California and they were really aware of that they had to design the hospitals so that they would really be more places of healing instead of just curing. So that was mainly my experience. It also was extremely, extremely competitive. There was really a lot of qualified healthcare architects that were competing for some really huge projects. And UCSF Mission Bay, I'm sorry, that's what it's called. UCSF Mission Bay is the three hospitals that I coached the winning team to win the project. And it was a huge project. It was like $2.1 billion and took a total of 8 years to finish the construction of the three hospitals. It was a big deal.
Sounds quite different to what you're doing now, which is basically coaching teams from startups to be articulate about what they're doing and to gain funding from investors. So what are your experiences with the digital health startups and the solutions that they're building?
Well, I moved to Europe 8 years ago, and a couple of years before I moved, I started focusing mainly just on pitch coaching. So I did presentation coaching for 17 years in San Francisco and Silicon Valley area, and as one of the things that I did, as well as strategic planning and executive consulting and conflict resolution team building. But the presentation coaching, I had designed a two-day course for their mid-level and top-level executives for my clients to understand how to fine-tune the value of what they were offering so that the people listening to it understood what differentiated their team and why they should win the project. So I had a lot of success with these huge projects. They won $400 million projects, $1.6 billion, $2.1 billion projects, and my clients did. And so I adapted the two-day training that I did for their presentations to turn it into pitch coaching, because the venture capitalists, basically you just have a slightly different audience and you have to adapt a lot of what I was already teaching just to a slightly different audience. So that's what I did in Silicon Valley before I moved to Europe. And then when I came to Europe, I just focused on the pitch coaching initially because there's a huge need, and I had a lot of success at getting good results from coaching my teams to win the projects they're pitching for, or to win investment. And so once I moved here, I started just pitch coaching for investment. So for the last 8 years, I've coached over 3,000 teams.
Do you see any changes in what a pitch coach needs to offer the teams that he or she is working with? Because, you know, investors kind of also learn the presentation styles people have. So that can potentially be problematic, I assume, if you're just working by a certain design and everyone's pitching in the same way.
Well, the thing is that people don't all pitch in the same way and don't do it well. That's the issue. You have to pitch from your own authentic voice. So you have to find your voice. And many people have a little bit of difficulty because they're not clear about what they should be focusing on for their pitch and what they shouldn't be focusing on. So that's the first thing. It's like, what does the investor, what's their mindset? What do they want to hear? And since I've moved to Europe, I've coached 250 healthcare teams. So some are digital health tech, some are medical device and biotech. And then I've coached clean tech teams and AI teams and everything, fintech, edtech, agtech, food tech, everything.
What do you see as different pitching digital health solutions or healthcare solutions compared to other industries?
Digital health solutions have to show that they can have a payer, like the health insurance companies will sort of value it. That's their hump to get over, the barrier to get through, is that you have to be able to prove that what you're creating actually is medically valuable. And therefore, and it has to do it every time that someone uses your app or your platform. And the ideal is to have health insurance companies pay for it. So when you can have that, when you can get assurance agreement with health insurance companies that they're going to be paying for it, or that you've got a payer identified that is viable, that's the hump. That's the issue for digital healthcare. And the other thing is in digital health is that there's a lot of noise out there. You know, there's like a lot of different companies doing a lot of different things. So how do you rise above all of the great things that are happening and have everybody know and then make sure it can scale? And that's always a problem for a lot of companies.
So how do you do that? What are the main problems people face, the main mistakes that they make when they try to create a pitch?
I don't know if it's a mistake that they make, but one of the things they need is they need to have launching customers or launching partners that have in their local area where they are first creating their app. You know, maybe it's in a certain country and in Europe, make sure that they have enough hospitals and payers and insurance companies that are interested in it and they can get traction locally and then they can scale to other countries. Or if there's a insurance company that is sort of cross boundaries, which I'm not sure if there is, but if there is, that would be the ideal type of thing to get connected to. So it's about launching partners and launching customers. You have to show that you have a pilot, that you have uptake of people using your technology and that you've gotten results.
So how do you approach understanding a specific problem? Because sometimes solutions are very technical, difficult to understand, and a lot of people that come into entrepreneurship from the technical side can get stuck in the technical details that can be very complex to understand for those that are not as technical as they are.
Oh, well, you just have to ask enough questions to understand. I have to be able to explain it basically and simply so that I understand it. And once I understand it, then everybody can understand that because I am not an engineer or a technical doctor. And I have worked with, you know, quantum physicists at Yale University. I've worked, you know, in biotech. I've worked with everything. It doesn't matter the technology. What matters is if they can explain it and simplify it so they don't use any jargon and they simplify it at a level that allows the investor to really clearly and simply understand what they're doing. Now, that doesn't mean that they have to dumb it down to the point to everybody they talk to. It's not dumbing it down. It's just simplifying it and explaining it clearly. Because once they're in a conversation with someone who's in their conversation and they're sure that that's the right person, then they can go back and talk about with their jargon, et cetera. But initially, when you're in front of a group of investors, odds are that they may not be in your conversation. You know, they might have some idea of it. They might not be an expert in it, and you have to be able to simplify it.
What would your advice be on how can people simplify their missions, their ideas, their solutions?
They try to explain it to someone who's not in their field and see if they understand it. And if they don't, allow them to ask questions about what it is they're doing. The key thing they have to figure out is what's the problem they're solving for? What is it there or a solution is doing? How does it work simply? And what else is out there that is sort of the benchmark, but what are they doing that's better and different? And you know, what projects are, where are they in the process of getting it to market? And how are they going to get paid for it? So, I mean, a lot of people, they leave out the paying part. You're not clear about how they're going to make money doing this, right? And for digital in healthcare, that's extremely important, right? It's like you can have a great digital healthcare application, but if you can't prove that it works, number one, and number two, you don't have people lined up willing to pay for it, then nothing's going to happen.
Do you see any changes in the last years, given that digital health is rapidly expanding and changing? There's more competition. What does that mean in terms of how you, as an entrepreneur, can pitch your solution in front of an investor who has heard 500 pitches before you?
Well, I mean, all investors have heard 500 pitches before you. An average investor hears, reads 1,200 decks every year. At least 1,200 decks come across their desk every year. Then they meet 500 people face-to-face. They do due diligence on 50 of them, and then they invest in 10, and they get the return on investment they want on one. So that's sort of who they're talking to. So the investor is looking for reasons to say no to you. So once you realize that, you have to figure out, you know, what is a reason for them to say yes? And one of the reasons for them to say yes is if you have traction in the market. So you know, how many people are using this? How many people, what's the impact been? What are your metrics about it? You know, what's your network like? Do you have partners? Who have you lined up as partners that are like really high up in the value chain of people that matter for your technology? And how networked you are, and who you have sort of on board, either as advisors or as first pilots, or they're done with the pilots and now you're going to actually implement it and install it across, you know, a number of hospitals in a certain country or a couple countries, or you're expanding. All of that is what they're looking for. They want to know that there's momentum moving forward to scale, and that you're getting really good results. So then you need good metrics.
So what is, in your professional opinion, the role of individuals' appearance, confidence, and charisma? Because a lot of investors, especially in the US, will say that the idea is not as important as the team, because, you know, if the team is right, then they'll make things happen, even if it's not the original idea that was presented to them.
Right. Well, I read some numbers a few years ago, about 4 years ago, that said that in Silicon Valley, I think it was in the 80 percentile, of ideas the entrepreneur got a term sheet signed, and 83 or 84% of the people changed their technology by the time it actually got to market. So sometimes it was small changes, sometimes it was large changes. So yes, that's true. It is the team. It's extremely important.
Just that, to which extent the team is important in the solution that you have?
A year ago, I coached two teams. So they're both groups of five people, and they're both pitching for $450 million from the EU out of Horizon 2020 money. One was for the EIT Urban Mobility, and the other one was the EIT Manufacturing. And they both won. They were competing for 7 years worth of funding. It was $450 million each, plus matching funds of, with both groups, it was 1.1 billion euros of matching funds for 7 years, and to drive innovation through industry, academia, and in business creation over the next 7 years across Europe, and then and drive innovation in urban mobility and drive innovation in mine manufacturing. When I was coaching those teams to win, I did some research, and there was some new research based on all this data they have now that shows that if you show up overconfident, and I don't mean arrogant, but that you just are 300% sure about what you're saying, that you have a 58% better chance of getting the money or winning the project or getting hired, for instance. And if you show any hesitation, they think you're incompetent. Incompetent, just because you're hesitating. Your demeanor and how you deliver what it is that you have to offer really, really matters. What you're saying, the content matters also, but your demeanor has to be aligned and really support the verbal message, the words that you're saying. So it has to all be aligned. So you have to choreograph how you're going to move your body. You have to sort of figure out how you want to use your voice tone, because, you know, your voice tone and your body language make up 93% of what they're actually absorbing in a presentation. Only 7% is the words. If your voice tone and body language are not aligned with the message. So if you go up and you've got this great message to deliver, but your voice tone and body language are not really supporting that because you're being hesitant or you're looking down or you're talking too quickly or you're not looking people in the eye or you're not being confident enough in how you're presenting your information, you're not going to get the money.
Sounds like a lot of work for somebody that has to be authentic on top of everything. I imagine that, for example, if you're an introvert and you're shy, it's very difficult to adopt all the skills that you mentioned.
Right. And everybody can learn how to be a better presenter, a better pitcher, something to pitch better. They like to hear from the CEO when they're pitching, sometimes the CTO, but I think they prefer the CEO. But sometimes you have to figure out who's better at pitching than you are. Sometimes if you're not really good at it, you can get better, but you have to really, really spend a lot of time to make it work. In fact, even if you're great at it, it's going to take you an average of 90 to 100 hours to prepare a 5-minute pitch. And that means not 45 hours each of 2 weeks before you pitch, but over an elapsed time of I don't know how many months and different iterations of trying, you have to really perfect it so that it's flawless. So you understand exactly what comes first, what's second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, ninth, tenth, and what it is they are listening for. What are the signals they need to sort of hear that allows them to light up and say, great, let's either have a meeting, or if they're in the meeting, they'll say, okay, great, let's talk about term sheets.
To be interesting, one of the options you can choose is to tell a story, a compelling story that makes people listen. The problem, however, is that, as I alluded to before, sometimes stories can get similar. I remember a few years ago, healthcare digital health investor said to me that he's bored with all the stories about the son that has diabetes, you know, or a person having a specific illness.
That the investors are being desensitized to this, the gravity of the problems.
Exactly. How do you see the trends, or do you adapt to that in your advice that you give to startups? What's currently interesting to...
Investors is to, if there's traction, if there's a big market, there's traction that they're farther along on the trajectory to getting things approved so that they can get to the market, that they already are in the market and they've got things momentum and moving and they're going to make money. That's what makes them excited. So, you know, the stories about, you know, the illnesses and your family and your things, people that have tragically hurt or died. You know, I've heard tons of them myself, but it has to be, you can use them, but it's how you use them that matters. You have to just touch very lightly on it so they understand your framework for why you're doing this, perhaps, but not lean too heavily on it to turn them off to think, oh God, here's another one. So there's a delicate sort of balancing act that you have to do. And that's part of what I work with my clients to make sure that they don't lean too heavily on it and that they insert their story if it's appropriate, and then how they insert it also, so that it's just the right amount and not too much, and also at the right time. And sometimes, you know, I've told people, don't tell us, that's not important for what they're looking for. So it depends on the situation.
Does it also help build credibility?
I mean, yes and no. I mean, you can have a personal experience and you can know more about it, absolutely. But you're also, I mean, the investor might think that you're emotionally biased and not open to really see clearly where the problems could be, the risks and the advantages, et cetera. I mean, you could, you know, might muddy the water a bit because you're emotionally good. So that's why it has to be very delicately introduced when you're pitching, if appropriate. And then the other thing is to just, again, they'll get excited if they can see that it really is something real that you have to offer, that there's a payer for it and they're going to make money. Because there's a big enough market that's out there, enough people who have this illness that you are solving for, and that you have traction towards getting it out there. You've got launching customers and partners lined up already, and now if they can just jump on your bandwagon and make money. You know, and that it's clear, you've got a clear pathway to how to make money for them.
Has it ever happened to you that you came across a project that somebody hired you and you realized that the team is, I don't know, awful or the idea is so weak that it's impossible to get it into competing shape?
Yeah, a few times it has. I have to say that most of my clients that come to me have been vetted by accelerators or incubators that are quite reputable. So I'm not the first stop for someone with an idea. It's already been vetted by some really experienced people. So it doesn't happen very often. A handful of times out of 3,000 companies, you know. So yes, but not much.
But what do you do in that case? Do you try to help the team?
I just tell them, look, you know, you're in a super crowded space. You don't have the right team. You're missing some key people in the team that you need, if that's the case. And you need to go back to the drawing board. I mean, I can coach you, et cetera, but it's going to be difficult to get investors interested in you.
Startups are usually small teams. And the project that we mentioned before, when it was about building a completely new hospital, was obviously completely different. Can you allude a little bit to what was the difference in working with different sizes of the team and the effect that you could have as a facilitator, a graphic, basically negotiator, strategist?
UCSF Mission Bay pitch presentation, there ended up being 55 people on the team and at least 40 different consultants. Some of them were the city of San Francisco. It was really quite complex. And so I coached the team that was pitching. I don't know. They had a lot of different people involved. They invited thought leaders in. Bill McDonough, who was wrote From Cradle to Cradle. This is, he came in, he was one of the consultants. So we had a lot of brainstorming sessions ahead of time to sort of see what some of the newest ideas were. And it's like healthcare of the future ideas, like what, because they're designing these three hospitals, but they had to design it to sort of be there for 40, 50 years and be sort of cutting edge. So there are a lot of different people. And so it was just about keeping things moving, getting clarity, making sure things didn't get bogged down, and then coaching them at the end to make sure that they handled the questions and the possibilities. And the company that I was working with, they spent $300,000 on the proposal, because it was $2.1 billion project. So, and they won. But there are other competitors, other companies that spent something similar and didn't win.
To which extent were nurses and doctors and medical staff included in that project?
We had big meetings of the nurses, the doctors, the administrators from UCSF that were in big facilitated meetings and with the architects. And you know, you had citizens groups coming in to talk about what they wanted as patients, the nurses, the doctors, administrators, everybody.
And if I understand correctly, basically your job as a facilitator was to bring all these people together.
Well, yeah, the architect sort of invited everyone, and then I helped facilitate some of the meetings, and then I also helped facilitate the actual interview where they were, before the interview, prepare them for the interview. And I've been working with that particular firm off and on for years, coaching their top level and mid level executives to make sure that we could raise the presentation level of everyone, you know, mid and upper level, so that they had a very wide and deep team of people who were qualified to articulate the value of who they were, what they did, that differentiate them, because it was very, very competitive.
Based on that, do you have any advice for bigger companies, bigger teams, because you also work with corporations, and when you have more people, you have to be more organized, and it's more difficult to keep the employee satisfaction. So based on your experience, what would your advice be? How to maintain that once the company grows? This also goes, you know, to startups.
You have to have meetings that are sort of touch points along the course of the project. So you have a kickoff meeting that gets clarity about, you know, what the vision is for this project and mission, and then you get clarity about the roles, who's doing what on the project. You sit together and do that. And if you're in, you know, in other countries, you have to have some remote people, but it's good to bring people together in person if you can. And then different phases of the project, you'd bring people together again. So I had meetings with different projects that, like, I had 30 different project meetings over the course of the years. And they went from projects that had as few as 8 people in the project to 55 people in the project. And you would then talk about, you know, what was working, what wasn't working, what could be improved, and then what were some of the target dates for the project, what was behind, what wasn't, if there was agreement, how to handle conflicts, just decision-making, communication on the team, all of that had to be, we talked about it, and you agreed on how to set it up, and then you followed it, and then you checked in to make sure it was being followed. And then with some of my teams, I'd set up, train the leaders to do a short coaching, 15-minute coaching session with sort of a maximum of 6 people under them once a month to be able to sort of get their finger on what was working, what wasn't working, and what they needed to improve on.
A lot of organization and a lot of coordination.
Yeah, communication, right. A lot of communication. You have to ask and listen and then adapt and make changes based on what's happening. And if you didn't do that, things get out of control and people get unhappy and not productive because it really gets into problems. And I used to hire me when they had projects that were on the edge of getting sued between the, say, the healthcare architect, the hospital, which is the client, and the construction company. And I would go in and facilitate. Basically, I would interview everybody, find out what was going on, and then I would facilitate a series of meetings, see if we could redo the communication and identify what was in the way, and, you know, and then resolve it. And things worked out. I had a really good track record on that. It was difficult, but a good track record. So those are large projects. Now with the pitch coaching, they're shorter term and they're for a lot of money in short term. So it's from, you know, $250,000, $500,000 up to 20, 30, 40, 50, 100 million. Or if it's consortia, like 450 million to 2.1 billion, depends. And I've coached, you know, teams that are looking for money, but I've also coached people who are looking to be partners in big international law firms. I coached one of the youngest partners ever to become partner at Clifford Chance Law Firm. And I'm a pitch coach for University of Oxford. They have a new Oxford Foundry, which is their new accelerator. And at Imperial College, I was there with the EIT Climate Kick for years and the EIT Health. And you can adapt depending on who you're talking to. You have to understand what their key motivations are. What is it that are they looking for? And once you understand what they're looking for, you just need to adapt your problem and your solution and to what it is they need to hear, if it's adaptable.
You've been listening to Faces of Digital Health. If you liked the show, make sure to subscribe to be notified about the next episode automatically. If you have a minute, I will be extremely grateful if you leave a rating or a review wherever you get your podcast. It really supports the show. Stay tuned.